Love in the 21st Century is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by CSU Chico Continuing Education, Open University. Open University provides an opportunity for individuals to take Chico State classes on a space available basis without going through the admissions process. More information about Chico University is available by calling CSU Chico Continuing Education at 898-6105 or by visiting rce.csuchico.edu. Here we are on Love in the 21st Century on a Tuesday afternoon. So what a great song. Thank you, Adam.
Oh, one of my favorites. Yeah, thank you.
Here we are talking about love and awakening and a conversation or topic that was brought up and suggested by Adam. So it's really excited to finally have the opportunity to have the conversation on the air of what inspired love and awakening and to hear what you have to say in terms of where we're going, where the conversation will lead us today in regards to love and awakening.
Well, I hope that by the end of this conversation, we will all have completely cast off all of the obstacles and complications that we use to make our own and others suffering, and then just fully adopt a pure, loving attitude towards initially, of course, oneself, and then all the limitless others. So that's what I'm envisioning happening here.
That's ambitious, but I'm there with you. Let us do it. Let us attempt at least the beginning, approaching the gate.
It's a trick question because, you know, I'm a Buddhist, and Buddhism, it's the main function is about awakening, enlightenment, and that such a thing is actually possible was demonstrated by the Buddha and subsequently by his students who followed and put it into practice and step by step actualized it, you know, had experiences for themselves. So, like, a lineage, in a sense, of living masters that have originated from that time and continue into the present. You know, when I think of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, these great examples of beings who really seem to have, you know, like some totally different operating system to the way they're working their brains and experiencing the world. Like, being around these people in real life, you get that there's something totally different, and that this thing that's totally different is something that's possible. They weren't necessarily born that way, but they were able to make progressive step-by-step changes within themselves to arrive at a condition or an ongoing experience that we would say is awakened. And this awakened state has this very natural loving responsiveness that's, it's like nothing separate that they have to do, you know, to be loving or something. It's like comes, it seems to come automatically with that position of actualization. Then we have to backtrack. You know, we start first with this fantastic intention, like our motivation, like the motivation for sharing this is that the suffering, the individual difficulties and hardships that beings face diminish, that be able to be overcome more easily. So this type of motivation that we're aspiring to, when we look into such a grand topic, you know, it seems so, in the everyday world, so almost inconceivable. We just raise up our motivation, raise up our own intention. Why is it that we want to look into these things? Well, it's because that there is this condition of suffering in the world. And we say how the Buddha worked as a doctor would work, and said that all the things that are arising in our experiences are due to causes and conditions. What's that? He's like a scientist. He's saying, you know, oh, it's not your punishment, it's not this and that. It's, there's causal links between all of the phenomena, all of the beings. Everything is arising due to interconnectedness. So when I make the causes, when I produce the causes for a particular style of my own suffering, those causes ripen, and then I experience that suffering. But that's not a permanent condition. That suffering occurs to the extent that I've created those causes. When I stop making those causes, then it has to dry up. You know, the effects of those causes, they go away too. So that's the good thing about karma. Mm-hmm. You can work it. You can use it to your own advantage.
Can I ask what from the Buddhist or from your own personal perspective, does that mean to be enlightened or to be awakened?
Good question. Number one question.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that natural state, which is fundamental to all beings, has been actualized. So nothing is added. Buddha had Buddha nature. You have Buddha nature. It's what is the basis for your mind to be sentient, to have self-awareness. Buddha actualized that Buddha nature. That is to say, removed the obstacles for its full expression, and allowed the natural qualities, the perfect qualities within that Buddha nature to shine forth. Like love, loving kindness is one of those qualities that's natural to that Buddha nature. So nothing to buy, nothing to add, but a little effort to do on your own side. They say we want to gather the accumulations of merit and wisdom. And first, I was talking about merit, this idea that what the world is giving back to you is what you've been putting out. If it's been a mixed bag putting out, then the world gives you a mixed bag. If you refine it and you're putting out, you know, intentionally more love, more helpfulness into the world, that's going to come back to you. So that's basically the idea of accumulating merit. Meritorious karma, it brings back blessings, which makes the path smoother.
Right. So then it seems as though self-awareness, becoming really aware of where one's motives lie or what drives one's behaviors, is a path to enlightenment. Absolutely. Or being awakened.
100%.
All right.
And it's sounds something good. It's something that we can always refine.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a simple kind of funny little bit about mathematics. I go like inversely proportional. You know, if you have a lot of expectations mm-hmm. in a situation, in a relationship, they're liable to be
to come down,
to be not met mm-hmm. necessarily. So there's an inverse proportion of expectation to intention.
Mm.
The more you bring to a situation what you can bring, what your intention is, the less you dial down your expectations naturally. So this thing of what's the most pure motivation? How can I refine my intention?
Mm-hmm.
Is the start of accumulation of wisdom. First we talk about the accumulation of merit. Then we talk about the accumulation of wisdom. These go together like the two wings of a bird. They happen simultaneous, and then you can soar in the heavens.
Mm-hmm. Sounds great. I have a question about what you were sharing around the idea or the service to others in alleviating their suffering as a intention for oneself. And I find that interesting because I guess I need it to be clarified. Not because I don't think that it's important to make choices and have actions and behaviors that are not going to cause harm to others,
mm-hmm.
but that I found in my own meditation and my own experience at Vipassana, mm-hmm. when they were sharing about the idea of suffering and sankharas and karma, mm-hmm. and how we each have these sankharas to mm-hmm. tend to,
mm-hmm.
that we can't actually tend to anybody else's sankharas. We can.
So let's help unpack. This mm-hmm. is one of those beautiful, massively profound Sanskrit words.
Right.
I'll ask you a question. What does sankhara mean?
Sankhara, as I understand it, is karmic material, karmic energy that you've accumulated in this lifetime and possibly, potentially, past lifetimes, whether they're positive or negative,
right.
that we focus on, that creates more of that in our life. So
okay.
if we focus on the negative stuff, it draws more negative. It just builds and multiplies more of that in our life. If we focus on attracting things that we want just for the desire of wanting them, it creates that. And so in that philosophy, there's the craving of it and the averting of
right.
it.
So the the purification, you're saying, like how there's three aspects, like mental defilements, like cognitive
mm-hmm.
dissonance. The way that I'm viewing the world is not the way it is. So how I'm thinking about things is wrong, and my actions are going to be wrong, and they're going to create more karma for me.
Mm-hmm.
There's also emotional defilements.
Mm-hmm.
They say like how, you know, if I act on hatred, if I'm feeling hatred and I act on it, then for sure I'm going to make some negativities and some karma. Similar, jealousy, pride, all of these types of negative emotions. Then the karmic traces, it's like once you go down a path, like we're going to the rainbow gathering, you know, first it's just wild forest. Then a bunch of people start living there, and then we find the quickest way from one place to another, and we make a path. And then folks are walking it, and it gets deeper and wider and more easier to follow.
Right.
Can be good, can be bad, you know, but that's how also neuroscientists, we've seen, you know, they say the neurons that fire together wire together. Mm-hmm. That we make a neuronal pathway, and it's easier to go that way once we have some training in our mind. But we humans, we have such intelligence, we can train ourselves in completely contrary ways. We can develop, you know, use this intelligence to make greater and greater weapons.
Right.
Ridiculous. After a certain degree, that's totally unnecessary. But able to use our intelligence to genuinely extricate ourselves from the suffering. And I hear what you're saying, like how what we can offer to beings, you know, in the sense of being a part of a growing community, of sharing a vibe, tending towards more freedom and more acceptance, more inclusion feeling, inclusiveness feeling. This is what we can do, you know, for members of our community that helps them to have less judgment, to, you know, against them, and to feel more of a part of something that's emerging.
Right.
Because the generosity part of our nature is something very natural, and indeed like comes from nature, how Mother Nature wants to heal us, wants to nurture us, wants to provide us what we need. That's the basic understanding. We have this appreciation for our earth and for the bounty she's always sharing with us.
Mm-hmm.
Then we want to be able to share with others what they need. So generosity. It's something that creates a feeling of abundance.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter if it's actual, like, physical wealth. There's this thing in Rainbow, because I'm thinking about Rainbow Gathering. We have this beautiful annual happening in Oregon this summer. But one of the ways you can tell someone's a rainbow, like down to the very last morsel of food, I'll share with you. Mm. If I got two bites, you can have one. Mm. You know, get down to that. But genuinely, like the first thing of being able to share with others appropriately and what they need is the first step in having the karma be smoother, having the cause and effect relationship become more harmonious. So we can be generous with physical support for beings. We can also be generous with fearlessness. If someone is really worked up over something that's actually not going to harm them, and you can help them, you know, help them down a bit, you know, take a couple breaths, it's all right. That's something you can give. And then, of course, we say, like, the gift of Dharma. And what's Dharma? Dharma is how Buddha communicated the path to that awakening. And it arose in response to the suffering of beings. They say Buddha taught 84,000 different gateways to the Dharma. Why so many? Because there's 84,000 different types of hang-ups and bang-ups that we create in our own minds. And there's one just for you. Yeah. It's not one size fits all. Mm-hmm. It's like where you meet it and how you find it, right, and how you can put it into practice. That's right. That's Dharma.
So I guess, and this happens for me at times when I ask a question and I sort of get an answer,
yeah,
you know, and your answer has definitely elaborated it for me, that you still in my perspective, though you can't truly alleviate another suffering, it's a personal action upon themselves of which they choose to engage with, whether or not whatever action you take.
That's right.
You can give the gift of generosity or the gift of fearlessness to help them in their way of maybe possibly seeing a greater truth. But in the end action, there is only you, your source, that makes that decision of whether or not you choose your own suffering, whether you choose to continue to anguish and pain over mental suffering or not. And I can't remember the TED Talk that I listened to, but it was a doctor. He was a doctor who had lost his arm and his leg as a young boy due to an explosion, playing with some rocket or something. And he talked about his working with people who were terminally ill, and the idea that, you know, there's the two types of suffering. One that is physical suffering that we can't necessarily always get out of, and then there is the secondary suffering that we inflict upon ourselves because of our suffering. Mm-hmm. And how much power we give to that second type of suffering, and actually,
yeah, there's an expression, they say, oh, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional.
Yes, absolutely.
And then you're talking about like two types of happiness.
Mm.
There's a temporary happiness that we try to create for ourselves by the manipulation of our external environment.
Mm-hmm.
If I just get the right job, then I'll be happy.
Right.
If I just had the right partner, then I'd be happy.
Right.
All of those type of happinesses, which are important,
mm-hmm,
for beings, we understand as occurring at the relative level and on the external environment, and they come and go.
Right.
The degree to which we attached to something which initially gave us happiness is the degree to which it turns into something that causes our suffering.
Mm.
So Buddha said, you know, to not grasp.
Right.
To be in the awareness which is free of grasping. But we want to encourage beings to have those temporary happinesses where possible. You know, the relaxation, the joy, the kind of break from the intense suffering that those bring, they provide an environment for further cultivation, further refinement of your mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we say, here's Dharma Rap 101. The karma that's returning is the karma that you're burning.
Mm.
The karma that you're making is the future that you're taking.
Nice.
You can quote me on that.
Yeah, I like it.
But the point is that those temporary happinesses that we provide for beings then isn't the ultimate happiness. And when we're talking about a type of joyfulness, a type of resiliency from within that doesn't come and go, which is to be discovered within the individual, Then we're talking about something, you know, more along the second accumulation, which is accumulating wisdom.
Mm, yes.
And not available in stores, obviously.
No. No coupons for that?
No, it comes through one's life experiences.
So how do you acquire it if you had limited life experiences?
I was totally magnetized to Buddhist philosophy when I took it. It was a college course back at San Francisco State University in the 80s. I had this kind of, I was either going to take a class in AI programming or Buddhist philosophy.
There's a big difference.
I took both, but then the AI class finished. It was like the cosmic, you know, like which direction my life is going to take. But it was just so yummy, like coming home to things that in a way I had already known.
Right.
But didn't have the language to communicate. And there are these beautiful, amazing, vast words within the Buddhist tradition. You know, you said sankharas.
Mm-hmm.
But like the basic, like the first two words I ever met, samsara and nirvana, is this vast topics, big unpacking kind of multi-level, multi-layered words. And we were talking like how the suffering can compound itself. The suffering returns and it creates more suffering, and our fighting against it, reacting to it, creates more suffering. On and on it goes, interminably. That's samsara.
Hmm.
Nirvana, not just a rock band from Seattle, also has the meaning of cool, of extinguished. Like this fire pit of suffering, when all the fuel has been burnt, there can't be any more fire there.
Right.
Also, it has the connotation of a fearless realm, which corresponds a bit to our second form of generosity we were talking about earlier, where we can offer fearlessness. If someone's worked up, overly concerned about something that actually in no way matters, isn't necessarily immediately threatening for them, we could be cool. Mm-hmm. We could be more cool about it. So, initially, the path, the way that the Buddhists are approaching it, they say how the suffering of samsara is so pervasive. And I seek to personally discover a way free of that. The way has been traversed. There's these remarkable beings who have come before and have proven it. That's the interesting thing about it, too. It's not necessarily a religion of faith, but of confidence. Very much appeals to my scientific nature, that if you engage in something and it has this dependable result, then you can have confidence in it. So faith goes forward that way, in the sense of something that's going to be able to be applied and works.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, Love in the 21st Century, Adam Mose and Tamara Wickma talking about love and awakening, having a conversation from the Buddhist perspective, and Yeah, getting really philosophical and also very scientific at the same time.
Realistic. We like to be realistic about this.
Yes. So, from the perspective then of the Buddhist or the Buddha, what are ways to help in one's development of their self-awareness?
There is a really interesting article I just read from a psychologist. And all of these terms, it's interesting, like we develop a language and a certain meaning for terms, even within the English language. Like we have these beautiful Sanskrit terms which have a large amount of meaning packed in them. But even when we say self-awareness, that can mean different things to different people. And my first impression was just that that there is an awareness present. Just the fact of your having a mind and being aware of that is sufficient. That's kind of curious. Because we were saying at the very beginning, Buddha nature is something natural, something intrinsic to each and every being with a mind. So we don't have to add anything. You don't have to receive anything. It's more of a getting used to what's already there. But the so it's simple. That's really easy. That's like too easy for our complex minds. Mm-hmm. We want to make it more of a project. We want goals. We want steps. Steps and goals. So we say there are these ways in which we can, if we've gotten ourselves into some sort of unnatural way, if what we think is natural is unnatural, then step by step we loosen that up. We can relax our hold upon a particular view, a particular way we're looking at things, thinking that's the only way it is possible, and become more open-minded. I always love, mind is like a parachute. It works best when it's open.
Yes, but safer.
But mind itself is vast, vast topic. And it's always understood in a partial way in our modern psychology. Because it's kind of like the illegitimate child of science. You know, there's like physics is like the big science. And biology is a little bit softer. And neurology is even more soft. But psychology, it's like really kind of mushy, wishy-washy. I'm totally joking. This is all tongue in cheek. But you were saying, like the Vipassana course, you know, people have these wonderful techniques that come from very ancient traditions and have been tried and tested throughout the years. When you engage in them, you have some very distinct, profound experiences. I love the work of the Goenka group, the Vipassana centers throughout the world. It's mm-hmm. an amazing movement and a wonderful organization run entirely on volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's genuinely in every country. It's all around the world. But you can go for 10 days and learn how to meditate in a very classical Buddhist sense, how it came from India and was preserved in Burma. And you get to experience some of the real peace and quiet that's possible within your own mind.
At times.
It gets to that.
At times. Though it's pretty loud inside your mind when you're there. At least that was what I realized, is how loud my mind is. It's like, wow, I feel like everybody could hear how loud it was inside my mind.
Yeah. It's a misnomer. They call it a meditation retreat. It seems like, oh, you're just retreating. No, it's an advance.
Yes.
You have to go boldly into your own mind and work mm-hmm. with what's there.
Mm-hmm.
But genuinely, after 10 days, mm-hmm. you get a taste, a little hint. There can be some quiet. There can be some peace.
Real peace.
Even if it's just for a moment between the thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So these techniques, these ways in which you can, it's not like, oh, you just, you know, get this Band-Aid and you put it on externally. You know, it's something that means we go to the depths of our mind and we heal it from within.
Right.
Through the application of the path.
Mm-hmm.
So that's first accumulating merit, then accumulating wisdom, then purifying cognitive, emotional defilements, and then karmic traces. All of that is what we say about the true love of the path, like how to fully experience the depth of that the Buddha's love can touch us.
Mm-hmm.
So I really so much value your opening it up, and let me bring a trick question. It's a trick question, obviously, because we love, you know, that's the main thing mm-hmm. in Buddhism is about the awakening.
Absolutely.
But we've always seen how they're interrelated, that the loving kindness that you feel towards every creature, everything that's alive, is so automatic. It's so very natural. When you come from these retreat, when I came from the retreat, it's like every little ant I'm looking out for. I see that's another mind stream with a Buddha nature there from their own side. The black widow spider, terrifying, you know, deadly, dangerous. I'm going to scoop it up in my little jar and put them safely in some distant field. Mosquitoes, sometimes it's harder. You got to give them a little brush off.
Yeah.
But that love also carries over into relationship, into the deepest of self-love. We see that, you know, the conditions that I make for myself, I'm going to have to experience. I'm going to start laying the seeds for wholesome experiences to return, for enlightening experiences to return.
Mm-hmm.
And the path to be clear, open, easy.
I like that. Clear, easy. I like it. Yeah, so thinking about love and awakening and how one can pursue that through a greater awareness of oneself, I think of an analogy that my friend used to tell me. A dear friend of mine that I grew up with and have known since I was probably like 12. Her name's Danielle. And she said, "You're like an onion. You know, you have to peel back the layers to, like, get to know you."
Yeah.
And I feel like that analogy applies to, like, self-awareness and becoming cognizant of the ways in which we show up in the world, because there was just something new that I become aware of, and I can't remember, but what exactly it is in this moment. Maybe it'll come to me soon, but it was around, what I was surprised by was the levels of self-denial that I had. Not obviously, it wasn't intentional self-denial. I wasn't trying to deny something to myself, but it wasn't until I really looked at it that I was like, oh, yeah, that's been there. And like, I mean, it's always been there. And I guess, you know, there were so many other things in front of it in terms of what else to be self-aware of and things that I was learning and lessons that I was developing, that I can finally get to that place and see that truth. And so, yeah, so I guess as awakening or enlightenment or self-awareness is a path that you get.
Right.
You're continuing to walk on it. It's not at some moment that you are there and then done.
Right. It always can deepen.
Mm-hmm.
It always can improve. And there's this thing of really trying to see oneself honestly.
Right.
And we naturally want to paint a more pleasant picture of ourselves.
Yeah.
More something that's more acceptable.
Right.
But in the depth of the meditation, when it's really just you and your mind, then you have the space to start to unpack and say, you know, who is this? How is this possible? And where can we go from here?
Right.
And the key to really go in the depths with that is to understand, I'll say it once again, we got that Buddha nature, which is already perfect, pure. Sane and good as that basis. So there's this thing like, oh, if I'm really getting more and more honest with myself, I'll see how tremendously horrible I am. You know, it you clear that stuff away. That stuff is secondary.
Right.
That's like the mud that sticks to the diamond.
Right.
The diamond fell in the mud and we pulled it out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all encased, it's all crusted over.
Right.
Sure enough, as soon as we start clearing it and rubbing it off, we get down to something that's hasn't been tainted, hasn't been harmed in any way.
Right.
And very importantly also, can't be improved.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to do any big self-development project, you know, self-help for your Buddha nature.
Just have to get through that mud.
And the mud comes and goes. It's something that's secondary. But the idea about denial is that, you know, we got half the mud still caking the backside and half is still showing and we're just like, yay, it's all done.
Right.
It's not all done. There's still more to go. So that self-honesty and that commitment to the path, to the methods that work your mind, you know, and lead to more wholesomeness.
Right.
It becomes more of an enthuse. It's like, want to get back into it. Want to get to that actual real joy of it. And I've had very many wonderful, wonderful mentors and guides over the years. and still do. And Chamchul Rinpoche, he's an amazing Tibetan Buddhist master from India now. And we just heard today that he's coming back in August. Mm. And we'll have, you know, more information about those dates. But we've hosted him twice before, and just a tremendous teacher and living example of, you know, what's possible with a lifetime of cultivation. You know, mm-hmm. It's such a breath of fresh air. Just amazing to be around these people.
Right. So if for someone that's listening that may be in the deep bowels of suffering, whether that is physical suffering or suffering that is being inflicted because of mental strife, are there any words of wisdom you would share with them in our last few minutes here together on the show? Any suggestions, directions to point them?
Well, like we were talking earlier, that the suffering that we're experiencing, like the karma that is returning, is the karma that we're burning. Like the good thing about bad karma is when you experience it, you burn it off. If I experience it and don't react and make more negativities out of it, then I finish with it. Not to be a martyr, but it's you know, like, more suffering, bring it on, I want to purify it. It's not like that. But you purify it, you get done with it, with the karma that's coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, if we understand that those hardships are coming about because of causes and conditions that only ourselves created,
mm-hmm.
then we completely dispense with the victim mentality. And you place yourself once again in the center of your universe. You're saying this hardship, this negativity, was from karma that I enacted. Causes and conditions that led to this, when they're finished, this suffering is going to be finished as well. So we don't have to fight against the effect, but we have to become cognizant of the cause. So it's like a little medical way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always do this in Chinese medicine. You know, I have this symptom. And it's like, yeah, we could put a Band-Aid on the symptom. But if we go and we go deeper and say, what's the cause of this? How is this life being lived that's giving rise to this situation? When we extinguish that cause, then that symptom goes away, can't come back.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like that 100% with absolutely each and every suffering situation. Rejoice.
Right.
That's a good thing.
Give thanks. Give thanks for that. And then just in our last few minutes, my real last question is, if for someone that's listening, or just for people that are in a place where they are suffering, that do not maybe believe that there is, that they have a way out, that they themselves are not the cause of it, there are only external circumstances that cause it, is there anything that you might say to that person to open a doorway, open a window to possibility, to help them to even see that there's a possibility to alleviate suffering?
Well, that there is this brilliant function to pain. Just in suffering and pain, it's something you actively want to seek a solution for.
Mm-hmm.
That's
some do.
Yeah,
there are some that do, and there's some that become so identified with their pain that it becomes that they have a relationship to it, that they feel that they identify with it.
Right.
That they.
But that's a kind of a pain that they have. You know, become addicted to or become.
Right.
So the actual genuine like definition of suffering is that which you
want to rid,
want to get free of.
So if you don't actually want to get free of it, then you're not actually suffering.
Yeah, then it's not. Well, then it's okay, not. Then. It's not. Yeah.
Fair enough. I mean, I'm okay with that answer.
Yeah. I'm depressed and I'm really enjoying my depression.
I feel like that was just like a Jeopardy answer. What is not suffering?
But it's that type of not suffering is different from genuine release from suffering.
Yes, I would definitely agree. But yeah. It also helped to bring some clarity in my mind of understanding, because I think that there is, to some extent, some joy or benefit that the identity or the ego receives from identifying with that pain. So it's not necessarily suffering, though it may appear suffering from the external or from the observer who is judging it.
We're getting into a whole other it's a whole other topic.
Yes.
Because it has to do also with the numbness. Like the ego gets to a position where it can't even feel itself or feel anything.
Mm-hmm.
So the pain is like to feel something and try to, you know,
wake it up,
be alive. That's different too.
Yeah, so fascinating. And another great conversation, I'm sure, to be had in the future. Thank you, Adam, for
thank you, Tamara,
being on the show, being here on a regular basis, talking about love, bringing the concept of awakening, whether it was a trick question or not. It was a great topic to be talking about. We'll be back next Tuesday with Desiree Susan, finishing up with our love and awakening segments. Stay tuned for Ecotopia. They're on every Tuesday from 6 to 7. Stephen and Susan Chudy, they host environmental issues with nationally renowned authors and activists. Ecotopia, it's your local link to a global network of folks who know and care about the health of our planet. We'll see you. Spread the love.
Please welcome the Moody Blues.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here with a few choice words about Donald J. Trump's presidency, which is keeping staffers and streaming news alert editors busier than a flock of seagulls at low tide. Watch the network television anchors, and you can see they're exhausted. That breaking news graphic broke. The new guy is making more missteps than the last place finisher in a drunken hopscotch tournament on cobblestones with a watch cap pulled over his eyes. Every day there's something. Right after firing his FBI director, the Washington Post reported the president shared classified intelligence with two Russian diplomats. But the White House said, relax, trying to convince the country that Mr. Trump was never in possession of any intelligence he could have shared. And increasingly, America is willing to believe it. The whole not in possession of any intelligence part. In defense of his disclosure of the classified Israeli intel concerning ISIS, Trump claims he can say anything to anybody because as president, he has special powers. Apparently, he was bitten by a radioactive spider. But the biggest and best and beautifulest radioactive spider ever. Now, Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein appointed a special prosecutor to get to the bottom of possible Russian collusion and obstruction of justice, the fastest any president in history has ever been targeted with a special prosecutor. He must be so proud. He's gone from zero to Nixon in less than 4 months. Next up, the president is scheduled to embark on a 9-day, 5-city foreign tour visiting Saudi Arabia, Israel, Belgium, and the Vatican, ending up at the G7 conference in Italy. For a guy who hates to travel and goes off script like church bells in Ireland, what could go wrong? The G7 used to be known as the G8 until Russia was kicked out for annexing Crimea. But now that they've annexed us, looks like they're back in the loop. For KZFR Radio, I'm Will Durst.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond.